At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. Hello, Judith. It is so nice to have you on the podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for inviting me.
No, it's very exciting to have you, especially to have a guest from across the pond. I always like to, you know, globally be speaking about eating disorders. So thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, I'm so ready to talk with you about my work. And, you know, I'm in the US, I'm in the Chicago area, but this work is relevant all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I guess talking of your work, for listeners that don't know, do you want to introduce yourself and tell us a bit about the work that you do?
Sure. I'm a clinical social worker. And so I see clients for individual work around topics related to binge eating, body shame, chronic dieting, weight stigma. I've been doing this work for well over 30 years.
And wow.
I've written several books about this, books for the general public, as well as for clinicians. Most recently, this past May, I released Beyond a Shadow of a Diet, our third edition.
Wow.
And as well as a couple months before that, a workbook that's meant for people who are struggling in their relationship with food, more on the binge eating side or the chronic dieting side. Feeling uncomfortable in their bodies, you know, having issues with body image. And that is also for people who are on this journey, but for clinicians as well. Each chapter, what I love about our workbook is each chapter has a section at the end called Clinician's Corner. So if a clinician is thinking about how to use the workbook with clients, it goes through what they should be thinking about, steps to take, how to reflect on their own attitudes toward dieting, food, and weight. And that workbook has been really popular. It's been really amazing to see what's happened.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And I think, you know, when I first saw your book, and the reason I was so keen to speak to you was I think that often binge eating disorder is almost, well, there's quite a lot of stigma to start with, but I think it's almost neglected sometimes in the clinical setting, because people don't maybe have the awareness of that they do maybe have other eating disorders. And so I guess for you, from, you know, your experience where you've been and the work that you've done, what was it that kind of led you down, you know, focusing maybe more on the binge eating and the chronic dieting?
Question. So I'm going to give you a little bit of history about how I came to do this work.
Yeah, definitely.
I did some postgraduate work in eating disorders. And at the time, this is in the late 1980s, the focus was anorexia and bulimia. Binge eating disorder did not exist as, as a discrete eating disorder. There wasn't a name for it.
Mm-hmm.
And after I left that, or while I was in that program, actually, I needed to support myself. And one of the part-time jobs I had was working with a medically supervised weight loss program. And so in that program, what I witnessed was people losing a lot of weight, but also either gaining it back quickly, which we know that actually that's what happens with any diet, that diets, most diets work in the short term, but just about any diet, 95 to 98% of people will regain the weight, and one to two thirds will end up higher than their pre-diet weight. So people, the more people diet, the higher their weights tend to be over time. And there's nothing wrong with being a higher weight. It's just that people are getting to them through dieting in an unnatural way. That's not where their bodies are meant to be. At the time I left the program, there were some people who maintained their weight loss, and this is just maybe a year out. But in order to do it, they were practicing really unhealthy behavior. So over-exercising, writing down everything that they ate, preoccupied with food and weight. And I had this feeling, if this is what I was helping people to do, to stay so preoccupied with food and weight, mm-hmm. I didn't want to have anything to do with this. That didn't feel like success to me. And around that time, I read a book, really one of the first anti-dieting books. We used to call it non-dieting. Now we say anti-dieting, called Overcoming Overeating, written by two New York psychotherapists. And what they were talking about was how the deprivation caused by the pursuit of weight loss, caused by dieting, was actually a trigger for the binging, the overeating, out of control eating that we were seeing. So when I read that book, it made so much sense to me, both professionally, and I had had a brief, I had some dieting in my background, and I had kind of come to that conclusion on my own that the dieting was actually causing some binges for me. So when I read that book, it was an aha moment. And I realized that that was the direction I wanted to go. And I have never looked back. So then what would happen is, you know, in my private practice, I would have people come to me who had had really great therapy and had solved a lot of their emotional, you know, difficulties, except eating. And mm-hmm. sometimes it didn't even come up in their therapy. They didn't tell the therapist, or therapists were like me, you know, before this experience, what I used to think is that if somebody was binging, we just needed to understand why they were turning to food. Like if we could get to the psychological roots, the behavior would stop. But that's just not how it works. And I can explain a little bit more about that. I think you have a question about that later. So I saw this happening, that people came to me from having really good therapy and were still struggling. And I love to write. And so in 2004, I wrote my first book, which was Beyond a Shadow of a Diet, first edition. And I co-authored it with Ellen Frankel, who's actually my sister, who is also an eating disorder therapist.
No way! Yeah.
It was really wonderful. We spent a lot, there wasn't Zoom at that point. There was phone calls. So we spent a lot of time on the phone talking about, we would write together, talk about our family. You know, it was a really wonderful, mm-hmm. bonding experience for us. Then in 2014, we did a second edition because in that decade, there was so much more research to validate this approach, mm-hmm. the what I call attuned eating approach. Popularly, it's called the intuitive eating approach. But these are anti-diet frameworks to help people truly make peace with food. And now here we are another decade later, in addition to even more research, just given how the world has changed, issues we've become more aware of, we wanted our book to not only be more current, but more inclusive. And so mm-hmm. we've been able to also address more marginalized groups and how that all fits in with this work.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that I'm super happy about is that you've said, you know, you wrote the second edition and the third edition because more and more research was coming out, you know, to back up what you had been saying before, which is just great to hear that the research has been there and also that, you know, it backed up what you were saying. But I'm also, you know, really grateful to you that you wrote those other editions to, you know, support marginalized groups. And I think, you know, we might come on to it later, but in the book you talk about social justice and things like that. And I think, you know, I've spoken about this with other people in the field as well, in that, you know, you can't just look at an eating disorder as your relationship with food. You have to look at all the other elements that, you know, play a role in their life as well, and whether that's how they integrate in community or, you know, their sense of identity and things like that. So it's such a bigger picture, isn't it, than just food? Yeah.
There's so many levels, you know, when I work with this issue, because there's just the concrete, the diet binge cycle and intervening mm-hmm. in that. And then there's the ways that food plays an emotional role. Now, food, like people talk about emotional eating. We all are emotional eaters. Like we eat mm-hmm. to connect with people. We eat at weddings. We eat at funerals. But we're talking about a reliance on food as a strategy, or in the case of anorexia, the way food isn't eaten as a strategy. Mm-hmm. to deal with some underlying issues. But then there's all the societal issues, right? All the cultural issues around weight and weight stigma, and the list goes on. So as a therapist, I'm working at a lot of different, integrating a lot of different levels of work.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think that's brilliant that you do integrate all of those different levels. And I guess just building on, you know, what you were saying about, you know, you realized that it wasn't just kind of understanding why people maybe had that reliance on food. There was so much more to it. And you know, I think in the book you spoke quite a lot about things like dieting and how they contribute to shame and disordered eating. And I wonder maybe if you could expand on that a bit for our listeners, you know, how you talk about that in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when people are binging, first, I just want to mention, because you were asking about binge eating disorder earlier. Mm-hmm. Binge eating disorder was added to, we have a diagnostic and statistical manual that we use for diagnosing. And binge eating disorder wasn't added until 2013.
Which is just mad, isn't it? Like how? Yeah,
well, that's when it was actually identified as a discrete eating disorder. And so often what people were being told is like, just put down the spoon, just put down the fork, as if it's that simple. And so often what happens, and this absolutely still happens, is that people go to weight management programs or to dietitians who aren't trained in this framework, or any of the programs out there that for weight loss, because they feel like they're out of control eaters. And one of the things we know is that, like I mentioned earlier, is that deprivation leads to binging. So if somebody says, starting tomorrow, I can never have ice cream again, what are they going to do tonight? There's a good chance they're going to have ice cream, whether they're hungry for it or not, and eat way more of it than they need. And that's what happens every time somebody plans to go on a diet, you know, starting Monday, starting New Year's Day, right? I'm going to be giving up all these foods, so I better get them while I can, right? I'm going to eat a lot of them. And just thinking about doing that is enough to trigger that deprivation. Another thing that commonly happens with clients, I see, I just had a new client come recently, and she likes to eat, quote, healthy. And so it's not that her foods aren't healthy, but in addition to those forbidden foods, and that's, of course, what she binges on at night, are the forbidden foods, she's not eating enough during the day. You know, so if somebody is under eating during the day, it's your body's wisdom that brings you to the food at night. So maybe there's something emotional going on. But what I always start with when I work with clients actually is ending that diet binge cycle, ending the deprivation. Because when that client goes to, you know, the bag of M&Ms or the pint of ice cream or whatever it is in the evening, how do we know if it's because something emotional is going on or if her body hasn't enough food that day, or she's, you know, responding to the deprivation. I'm not allowed to have it. I only have it for my kids, but I can't stop thinking about it. And what I say is those foods glitter, you know, the foods that are off limits glitter. So we really want to start by breaking that cycle. And the way the cycle works is that, well, I always like to start by saying, nobody ever looks in the mirror and says, oh my gosh, I look fantastic. I'm so healthy and I love, you know, my body. I think I'll go on a diet, right? It's always, my thighs are, you know, rubbed together. My belly sticks out. I'm not healthy. I better do something about it. And all of the diets out there, so whether it's, you know, keto or Whole30 or what else is popular these days, intermittent fasting.
Oh my God, we said it at the same time.
You know, even like people go low carb or no carb, you know, whatever it is, they work in the sense of giving some weight loss in the beginning. And when people are dieting, like in the beginning, it feels like this fabulous sense of control. Like it's very virtuous feeling. I got it this time. You know, it's like a high. And so you have to wonder if it feels so good to people, you know, and they start getting all those compliments too, right?
Yeah.
So you're taking such good care of yourself. I'm so proud of you. So you have to wonder, like, if it feels so good, why is it that upwards of 95 to 98% of people will regain the weight? And the answer is the physical and psychological deprivation. So I talked about the psychological deprivation. We want what we can't have. But there's also ways that the body, when it's not getting enough nourishment, it doesn't know that like thinness is the fashion of the time. It thinks that your body is in trouble. And through evolution, it wants to keep you alive. That's the body's goal. Mm-hmm. And so it will actually send out all these like warning signals. And eventually, in most cases, you know, unless somebody goes on to develop anorexia, the body will, between this physiological and psychological deprivation, that person will be compelled to go to the food. And when they do, they're not going for like salads and veggies and fruit, right? They're going for the very foods that have been off limits. And mm-hmm. that's where I talk about the shame that I think is the most insidious part of the whole cycle, because first people are given the message from the culture or from their pediatrician as a kid or from comments from, you know, relatives, parents, that their body isn't acceptable, that they don't have the right body. And then they do what diet culture tells them to do, which is to pursue weight loss. And when that fails, they blame.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
The blame and shame fall at the doorstep of the dieter instead of mm-hmm. realizing that the problem is in the product itself, in the diet. And so the tagline I've used for various books is, you haven't failed your diet has failed you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's, when you were just talking then, well, I was thinking about, you know, when it comes to family and friends and things like that, is I think the added difficulty when I'm speaking to people about binge eating disorder is that quite often people will appear in a larger body. And so people that don't understand eating disorders think that the treatment will be to lose weight. And so when then people, you know, have treatment for binge eating disorder and, you know, part of their treatment is not to lose weight, it's to start regularly eating, it's start eating those foods that they don't allow themselves to have, that they do restrict so much, that then causes so much conflict and then so much questioning from people that don't understand. And then within that, I think there's so much stigma and misunderstanding that makes recovery so hard. In contrast to, let's say, somebody that's in recovery from anorexia, it's almost, you know, it's praised when you start to gain weight through recovery because you've gone from being very thin to, you know, you know that they need to put on weight in order to recover. But with binge eating disorder, there doesn't seem to be that same understanding that the treatment actually isn't to lose weight. It's
so there's so many things I want to respond to and what you think, because there's so many misunderstandings about eating mm-hmm. disorder. So we can even start with anorexia, and I don't know if this, you know, what your experience was, but people often get complimented in that eating disorder. You're losing weight.
Oh yeah,
right. Okay. The flip side of that is that sometimes there can be a message: regain the weight, but not too much. So that the weight stigma is still there on the regain side. And I just want to comment, in case any of your listeners don't know, that we've come to understand better atypical anorexia, which mm-hmm. refers to people who meet all the criteria for anorexia except for body weight. And so there are a lot of people out there who are actually in higher weight bodies, whose bodies are starving, they're undernourished, and they're still being told to lose weight. They're not getting proper treatment if they go for eating disorder help. So mm-hmm. in general, what I want to say is that you can't tell anything about a person's relationship with food based on body size, based on looking at them. There are people at higher weights who, like you're saying, have binge eating disorder, but there are also people at lower, at, you know, what are considered normal, quote, normal or average weights, who have binge eating disorder. Mm-hmm. And there are people at higher weights who have a perfectly healthy relationship with food. Mm-hmm. So I want to just sort of put all that out there. And then what you're saying is absolutely correct, that what people assume is if somebody's higher weight, they must be eating too much and the solution is to go on a diet. If you look at the criteria for binge eating disorder, it doesn't say anything about weight. And so mm-hmm. recovery from binge eating disorder isn't, you know, some people, when they make peace with food, will lose some weight. Some people will stay the same weight. Some people may gain the weight, because often when you have people with binge eating disorder, they also have restrictive phases. They have times mm-hmm. where they are restricting, and they believe that that's kind of normal eating. That's how they're supposed to eat, but it's not sustainable. And the binge is just the flip side of the restriction, mm-hmm. right? So it's important for people, but even for clinicians, because there are therapists out there who believe if their client has binge eating, success will be weight loss, that will come with the healing. And that's not necessarily you know, every person is different. We can't know. When I start working with somebody with binge eating disorder, I don't know where their body's going to end, mm-hmm. and they don't either. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's a really important thing, you know, with regards to eating disorders in general, is that a lot of the time when people embark in recovery, their fear is, I'm going to gain weight. And, you know, people will say, like, well, how much weight am I going to gain? And when will my body stop gaining weight and all of this? And as a therapist, you know, you can't know that. And even if somebody was a certain weight before their eating disorder, their set point theory may be completely different now. And it's interesting what you were saying about atypical anorexia, because that's actually what I was diagnosed with. And initially, I did gain a lot of compliments from people. And, oh, you know, you're looking great. And I am a really big fan of the gym. I do quite a lot of competitions and things like that. So, but it's actually something I love rather than it being kind of, you know, it was a bad thing. It's not a bad thing anymore. But in that culture, so many compliments. And then I sort of tipped over the edge as to what was acceptable and people started worrying about me. And I found it a really good, not experiment, but also kind of social experiment to see when people were like, you know, those compliments came to them when it tipped over the edge of, okay, now we're actually concerned about you because you've lost a bit too much weight. Mm-hmm. And I've found that it's almost a similar thing in my recovery. You know, people, once they're aware of the fact that I had an eating disorder, I had anorexia, they're then, oh, you know, you look so well. But then, you know, there could be a point where someone would get to where then people would be like, oh, we're a bit worried about you because you've put on quite a lot of weight. And there's so much concern around weight and the kind of drawing a correlation between someone's health and their weight. But actually, absolutely, that's not something that, you know, you can do just by saying you're X weight, therefore your health is Y.
Which is why we shouldn't be complimenting people based on mm-hmm. body size ever. Mm-hmm. You never know what a person is going through, what's their natural weight. If they have a, you know, people who, I've heard stories of people with cancer losing weight because they have cancer, being told, oh my gosh, you've lost weight. What are you doing? You know, I have cancer. So yeah, we just need to stay away from that. And then, you know, what you're also really talking about is just diet culture and the weight stigma out there, this belief that one size is better than another, instead of there's, you know, all bodies, all body shapes and sizes, there's room for everybody, and all body sizes need to be respected and treated equitably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess, because I know that you touched on weight stigma, and you also spoke about that with like clinicians and medical professionals, from your experience of working within this industry, what would you say needs to change within healthcare for that stigma to go? Because I think there has been so much research that has said, you know, if you're overweight or obese or whatever, then you will have XYZ condition. And so people have got that correlation and it is not shifting. But we do know, you know, as more modern research has come, that you can't just say, because, you know, let's say somebody is diagnosed with a condition, you can't just blame that on their weight. There could be other confounding factors, which almost certainly there will be. But I'm unsure, you know, what needs to happen within the healthcare professional for people to actually hear that and understand that.
Well, that is a tough question because, like you're saying, medical students are typically trained in the mainstream paradigm of, you know, weight is a problem. And you use the key word, it's a correlation. Mm-hmm. And so if we actually look at the research, just a couple great examples. There was one that was a meta-analysis of, it was like weight and physical activity and health. And what it found is that if somebody is physically active, they may gain weight, lose weight, or stay the same, but their health improves no matter what. Their risk of cardiovascular disease. That just being fit mitigates any risk that comes from being higher weight. Whereas somebody who pursues weight loss gets caught in that cycle and they don't get any of the health benefits. Another really interesting study looked at, it's four factors. So if you are higher weight, so if you fall, I don't usually use the words overweight and obese because those are really stigmatizing words, but that's how the research is done. Mm-hmm. So if you're in what's called the obese category, and you don't do any of these behaviors, your risk is absolutely higher than somebody who is thinner. But if you don't smoke, alcohol in moderation, get your fruits and vegetables, and are physically active, that risk is gone.
Oh.
So that is the problem, is that, you know, people go to doctors and it's they get told to lose weight instead of helping support behaviors,
mm-hmm.
you know, that improve health regardless of whether any weight is lost or not. And, you know, it's not a moral issue. Nobody is obligated to practice those behaviors people should be informed that mm-hmm. that weight losing weight not only isn't sustainable, but we know that weight cycling actually increases risks for health risks. People who maintain a higher steady weight have less cardiovascular disease than people who weight cycle. So then the question is what you asked, like what is happening that the medical field doesn't know this, embrace mm-hmm. this? Like, this is really good news. People mm-hmm. can stop all of this weight cycling and going on diets that make them feel deprived and unhappy. Food should be a source of nourishment and pleasure, not angst and anxiety and all of this. There's a really good resource called the Haes Health Sheets, and you can find them at haes.com. And what they do is look at some of the major things people deal with. So, you know, high cholesterol, diabetes, sleep apnea, and it gives ways to address all of these issues without a focus on weight loss.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you know, I think it's important for anybody listening today, whether you're just somebody who is interested in these topics, who is dealing with your own dissatisfaction with body size, or if you're a health or mental health professional, these sheets give great information to use with no blame, no shame. The other thing I'll answer is say about the medical field, we're seeing I don't know the websites offhand, but I can certainly find them for you if you're interested to put them in the notes. But there's a group of like medical students that's gotten pretty big that is, you know, working on getting this in their education in med school. And then another group that was formed just a couple months ago, and I can't remember exactly what it's called, but it's like Doctors for Weight Inclusive Healthcare or something. That's not really the title, but that's the idea. Mm-hmm. It's an association. So we're seeing people have been working on this, but we're seeing some more associations developing to try to get mainstream doctors to be more involved or more understanding of this perspective.
Yeah, which is brilliant to hear that, you know, there's people that are, whether they're doctors or medical students, you know, really, that's really great to hear that the new medical professionals coming in are bringing that with them, you know, try and change the status quo. And I guess just in case people haven't heard of it or, you know, have heard a little bit, but they're a bit unsure, you mentioned Haes. And I just wondered, because I know that you talk about that in your book as well, if you maybe wanted to expand a bit more on what that is and what the premise is behind it.
Haes stands for Health at Every Size, gets abbreviated as Haes, H-A-E-S. and it's really a weight inclusive framework that was developed to be more inclusive of people of all sizes, as well as over time as it's developed to understand more about the intersection of fat, of a higher weight with other marginalized groups of people who are Black, you know, who are experiencing mm-hmm. multiple oppressions or disabled and on and on. But for our purposes today, at its core, it takes the focus off the pursuit of weight loss and it looks at other ways to support the body, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've mentioned some of those, physical activity, or, you know, these are just different practices. Eating foods for satiation and nutrition versus, you know, the weight loss focus, understanding how people who are at higher weights are marginalized and it affects things like employment because we see job discrimination.
Wow.
And even things like, you know, in my work with clients, I spend a lot of time talking about going to the doctor. I have so many clients who dread it. And I used to say they avoid it, but now I think about it a little differently. They're protecting themselves because they've experienced so much shame by the medical system. So even, you know, even part of being a health at every size informed provider or weight inclusive provider is helping clients find resources where they can be, where they won't be shamed. I've spent a lot of time helping clients try to connect with doctors who won't shame them, or at least having some skills. Like if they're told by a doctor, you know, to lose weight for their cholesterol, to say, have you ever seen a thinner patient with this health issue? And the answer is always yes. Like people who are higher weight aren't getting health conditions that thinner people aren't getting. And then they can say to their doctor, well, what would you tell your thinner patient? I want those same strategies. Mm-hmm. So it might be something like getting a medication, or being aware of the amount of saturated fat in a diet. Like making a decision about how to feed yourself based on a health condition is different than dieting for the pursuit of weight loss. Mm-hmm. Increasing physical activity can help high cholesterol. So, part of this is helping clients just really advocate for themselves.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think something that's really coming through there from what you've said is that this big focus, which I think it should be for everybody independent of body size, but doing these behaviors or, you know, eating in a certain way or physical activity in a certain way to prioritize your health and to enjoy yourself, none of it should be focused around, you know, trying to lose weight or go on a diet. And I think that's, you know, something that in society, I think we actually really struggle with, you know, exercising in a way that you enjoy rather than exercise as a punishment or the way that you think you should exercise in order to lose weight, or that you think you should exercise in order to look a certain way. And it's funny, I went to a conference the other day and one of the speakers stood up and she said, food is not just fuel. You know, nobody eats birthday cake because they're hungry. People eat birthday cake because it's a cultural thing, because it's enjoyable, because you're together and, you know, having a nice time. And that really stuck with me, in that, you know, food is, yes, there is a reason to have food in order to, you know, go and be able to do certain activities like go to work or spend time with your family or, you know, educate yourself or whatever, to use your brain. But there's also so much more to it than just that. And I think that's really what I was hearing from you there, in that just, you know, if someone's in a larger body, the way that they're told to eat or to exercise shouldn't be, oh, we're telling you to do this because you need to lose weight. It should be, we're doing this to help optimize your health, and in the same way that we're helping everybody else with that. And I also, you know, from what you were saying, you know, it sounds slightly concerning in that people are potentially going to their doctors and then almost being fobbed off and told, oh, just lose weight, whereas actually there could be a medication that could help them, or there could be another lifestyle intervention that could help them that they're not actually going to have access to until they've lost the weight, which that in itself, asking someone to lose weight, is a very difficult thing to go through anyway without support. You know, if someone, let's say, did need to lose weight, and I'm using massive quote marks there, to just say, go and lose the weight, it's also a massive underestimation of, you know, what you're asking someone to do.
A bunch of the different things that you just said. Yeah. Telling somebody to just lose weight, chances are they have tried.
Like, that's what I was trying to say. Sorry. I just really was not wording it very well.
I use this story when I do my professional trainings, of a colleague who told her students, if anybody can find a plan or program or diet where people can lose the weight and sustain it for 2 to 5 years, research shows that they can sustain it, the majority of people, I will give you extra credit. Nobody ever got extra credit because it doesn't exist. So it's really, from my perspective, irresponsible to be telling people just lose weight. And, you know, like there was one story that went viral a bunch of years ago about a woman who kept being told to lose weight, and it turned out she had a tumor in her stomach. And by the time they found it, it was too late, and it would have been treatable. You know, that's an and in her obituary, she wanted, Ellen Maud wanted people to know, women to know, if you think there's something wrong, like kind of that trust yourself. I don't remember her exact word. Mm-hmm. Wanted it in her obituary. So that's the medical field. And if we're being told to lose weight, you can ask your doctor, can you give me research to show something is sustainable? And I don't want to get into all the weight loss drugs these days. I think we'll eventually find there's some issues with that as well. That probably could be a whole nother podcast on that. But so that idea that somebody has to lose weight, like telling somebody to lose weight when there's no way to do it in a way that is sustainable and the weight doesn't come back, to me feels irresponsible. Mm. And there's always other things people can do to support their bodies. Around the exercise part, you know, I think it's still so important to like give people their own ownership of exercise. So yes, exercise is something that can support health. And it doesn't mean anyone's obligated to do it. Because for so many clients I work with, exercise was punishment, right? Mm-hmm. Wrong body, or I ate too much, not going to go work it off. And it becomes unhealthy. But I had one client who would call it torture. She'd work out for hours at a time. And so what I try to do is get clients to unhook exercise from weight loss. Like if your mm-hmm. body, and I even sometimes just don't use the word exercise because of all the meaning. So like movement, yeah. physical activity. But if you were like, if you knew that physical activity wasn't going to change your body size, would you do it? And I've had some people at first say no, but just about everybody eventually says, oh, but like, I don't want to lose my mobility, or I want to be able to sit on the floor with my grandchildren, or, well, I love dancing. Like dancing is just fun, or it's social, or, you know, I want to stay fit and flexible. Like, so finding other reasons to be active is, I think, really important for people to be able to know what is the reason I'm doing this. And mm-hmm. also that assumption that only, quote, you know, only, and I use the word fat neutrally. I know that can be feel like a shaming word. So you generally I say higher weight, but for this example, I just want to say if some, the idea that if somebody's fat, well, of course they need to exercise, but what about someone who's thin? If exercise is actually supportive for all people, and I gave some research before, but one more study is that when you look at people who are fit, so this was looking at men who were physically fit, were assigned the number one of all risk mortality. Men who were thin but not fit, their risk, if I'm remembering right, is 2.2. It's more than double. So we always assume a thin person is healthy, mm-hmm. but, you know, behaviors are what matter. And then if you have a higher weight person, so someone who falls in the obese category, and they're fit, their risk is 1.1. So barely any different.
Wow. Than
if they're not fit, their risk is, I can't remember if it's 3 or 3.1. So it's triple the risk.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying weight makes no difference, but again, that physical activity mitigates the risk. So mm-hmm. we can give our clients, or I give clients that information.
Yeah.
And help them look at unhooking physical activity from weight loss per se, and then they get to decide what works in their lifestyle, you know, and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I want to mention the food that you had talked about, like birthday cake. I disagree a little bit. I'm sometimes hungry for birthday cake. Like I'm hungry and I want something sweet and fat, and mm-hmm. like cake is perfect.
Mm. I think when they said it, they were more referring to the thing of like, you wouldn't, or you shouldn't, I guess, only eat it when you're hungry. Like, right. you know, you might have lunch or something because you're hungry. You don't always just have to have lunch because you're hungry. But I think the example was more like you
still have birthday cake because it's part of the self-nutrition. And it's, and yes. that's a okay. Okay. All right. I'm on the same page with that.
Yeah.
I talked about the diet cycle and why it doesn't work, but we haven't really talked about the antidote to dieting, mm-hmm. which is what I call attuned eating. And I'm sure many of the people who are listening to your podcast, you've probably had people on who have talked about it before. But in general, the idea is to really reconnect with your body and figure out, you know, and it's not the hunger fullness diet. I don't want to say it that way, that you could only eat when you're hungry and you have to stop when you're full. Mm-hmm. But if you can think of a time when you were hungry, and you got exactly what you were hungry for, how did it feel? Maybe you can answer that, Hannah. Like when you've been hungry and you get exactly what you're hungry for, how does it feel?
I think that very much depends on the food that I eat, but typically it's a massive relief. because you know, you finally, I'm just thinking back to when I was hiking in California, and you know, when we'd get back to the van and we'd sat down and we had our lunch, that sort of that relief in, oh, you know, I feel kind of back in my body because I've refueled myself.
Yeah, so relief. Sometimes people will say it's satisfying or they're content. Mm-hmm. Remember when I did that, when I asked this at a training, somebody said it's glorious. Mm-hmm. It was excellent. So it's a really wonderful feeling to be hungry and eat, you know, what will not only taste good, but feel good in your body. And then if I ask the reverse question, like, you know, what is it like when you're hungry, but for whatever reason, you're dieting or you can't afford it or it's not available, but you don't get what you're hungry for, how that feels.
Mm-hmm.
Share what that's like for you.
I think for me, the biggest thing is the distraction and the constant kind of, you're unable to do anything or think of anything other than food. Because when you've got that restriction, you know, whether it's that you maybe have eaten something, but it hasn't satiated you, or you haven't eaten at all, like, you're just not able to focus on anything because your body is just screaming at you, please, can you put some more food in me? You know, that's not enough.
It's a great point. Sometimes around what you're saying, I use the example of somebody who's having like a pizza party at their house, but they're being quote good. So they just eat the salad.
Mm-hmm.
You can get really full on salad without being satisfied. And then when everybody leaves, you know, they end up eating the pizza. They would have been better off having the pizza because that's what they were hungry for, and some salad with it if that's what they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So when people try to eat around the food, they often stay preoccupied. So the opposite, and when I ask people, you know, what was it like when you didn't make that match? You know, people will say they feel angry, they feel unsatisfied, deprived, you know, all those words. So that's sort of the, you know, what I work with people on is being more aware of their body when they feel hunger. What food would really, I call it making the match, but another way to think about it is what will really hit the spot.
Mm.
Our bodies like such a wide variety of foods. You know, I've never met anybody, you know, the fear people will have is, well, if I eat what I want, I'll only eat the potato chips and the ice cream and the chocolate. You know, I have never met anybody when they listen to their body who only wants the foods that are higher in fat and sugar, more than I've met anybody when they listen to their body who only wants salad and vegetables and fruit. Our bodies love variety.
Mm, yeah. I think, you know, for me, from my perspective, when I was, you know, at the initial point of my recovery, I will say that because I had been in restriction for so long and not had, you know, like all the foods I had not allowed myself to have, it was all I wanted all the time. And it was very difficult to embrace that. But actually, I think, you know, one thing that I look back on now in my own recovery and what I would say to other people was that it's actually okay to embrace that, and that won't be forever, because I'm now at a point where, you know, sometimes I am craving, you know, some broccoli. Sometimes I have times where I'm like, oh, I really fancy a banana. Other times I really fancy a donut, or other times I really fancy cottage pie with gravy and vegetables. And I think that just shows that, you know, your body, what it craves, it does change all the time. And yes, probably if you haven't had something for a very long time, your body is going to crave that. And also, you know, it feels very uncomfortable. Often that is high fat, high calorie foods, because you're in a your body is in a period of starvation. So it wants to have things that it hasn't been able to have before, but that does balance out. And I wish now I had just fully embraced that, because it would have been a lot quicker and easier to get back to the position I'm in now, rather than prolonging that for a longer period of time.
But you're there. So that's what meant. But what you're saying is so helpful. So first of all, you know, what you're describing is that once you gave yourself permission, right, to eat all types of food, you're seeing that your body wants all types of foods, and you're learning to trust your body.
Mm.
Your body is trustworthy. And that's what's key here, is trusting your body. There's so many experts out there telling you this is what you should or shouldn't eat, and it changes all the time, and it's crazy making.
Mm-hmm.
Versus learning to trust your body. And, you know, we talk about gentle nutrition at the end of our workbook. And, you know, there are things like you can decide, you know, gosh, I don't think I'm getting enough vegetables, I want to add more. But we think about adding versus taking away. We talk about, you know, cultures, like with vegetables, people have fun, you know, sauces. Like, I like my broccoli with cheese sauce, you know, plain vegetables, you know, on the side. And then the other thing that you're describing, which is absolutely true, it's a journey and you have to go through it. You can't just mm-hmm. hear this and say, oh, okay. You know, you're going to make up for lost time. Like for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to go through it. And in Beyond a Shadow of a Diet, we describe as a clinician how to help clients go through it. Although that book, when we first put it out, clients were reading it as well. So it's written in a way that I think is accessible to the general public as well as clinicians doing the work. Mm-hmm. The workbook actually helps people go through the steps also of like identifying, like if you're going to bring a fear food into the house, like one of your forbidden foods, you might want to start with your least fearful one. I've had people start mm-hmm. with peanut butter, or somebody start with hummus, you know, things that they've put off limits, and kind of, you know, just go through it and see, like, once I really keep it available with permission to eat it, I eat a bunch in the beginning, and then it's like, oh, it's always there. Actually, sometimes I even can forget about it now, and how nice when I'm hungry it's available.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's the thing, isn't it? It's like, as you just said, it's taking it as a journey and a step-by-step process and not expecting everything to change overnight. And I actually wanted to say that when you mentioned attuned eating or intuitive eating earlier, I think one thing that when I first was in recovery, I was like, I'm going to do this intuitive eating thing. Yeah, I'm going to do it. I'm going to be recovered and I'm going to do it. And because I was still in a very restrictive mindset, I was just very much like, I'm going to eat when I'm hungry and I'm going to stop when I'm full. Well, I have been in and out of anorexia for 14 years. So I had no idea what hunger felt like, what fullness felt like. It was a completely new sensation to me. And so for me, another thing that I've learned through my journey is that intuitive eating might not be the first thing to step into, and to actually, you know, start to understand what hunger feels like, start to understand what, once you've got hunger down, what fullness then feels like. It might feel quite mechanical at the start, but then as you grow and as you develop, you then can start to learn to trust your body and to, you know more what it needs. But I also think that something I didn't pick up on before as part of intuitive eating, it's also eating, as we were saying earlier, maybe when you're not hungry. You know, if somebody offers you a biscuit, having that biscuit because you want to have that biscuit. You know, there's physical hunger, but there's also mental hunger, and being able to be adaptive in that way. Because, you know, for me also, sometimes nowadays I'll have a bigger lunch, and therefore at dinner maybe I'm not that hungry, so I might have a smaller dinner, but then other times I'm absolutely ravenous despite the fact I've had that big meal. And I think back in the days of restriction, a bigger lunch would have had to result in a smaller dinner, whereas now it's more listening to what my body needs rather than what the eating disorder says.
Right, that you've come so far in your recovery that you can allow that to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, the population I work with generally is around binge eating disorder. So I'm going to start with that. Mm-hmm. What you're describing about, like, you know, I'm full, but I want to eat more anyway, or I'm going to have a biscuit because it just sounds good, I'm not really hungry. In those moments, somebody's feeling in charge, not in control, mm-hmm. but in charge. Like, I'm deciding. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's normal, healthy, positive eating. Versus a sense of feeling out of control. Like, that's what I look for. So, you mm-hmm. know, that birthday cake can be in charge feeling, like, oh, you know, I had lunch, I'm full, but yes, I want to participate. I want to have a piece of cake like everyone else. And it can be a binge where mm-hmm. I shouldn't do it, but I can't help myself. And the person feels out of control. So that's what I look for. Mm-hmm. Is in charge, or are you out of control? And yes, you're absolutely right. With anorexia, the brain isn't functioning in a way that somebody can tell, you know, that they're physically hungry or that they're full. That's the nature of the disorder. And so what we think about then is how, you know, a person at that point needs a meal plan, needs to get renourished, and then they can move into the intuitive eating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. I really love that distinction you've made there of, are you in charge or are you in control? Because I think that it just rung so true for me, in that, you know, back in the day, I probably would have said, I don't want the cake because I had a fear of the cake. Whereas nowadays it would be, actually, you know, I don't really want that cake, but it's not because I'm scared of it. It's because I just don't feel like it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something I never understood when I was ill, was, how can someone say no to birthday cake? Because I had restricted it for so long that all I wanted was birthday cake.
You know, you can have cake whenever you're hungry for cake or whatever. In the mood for cake. Then you decide from in this moment right now, mm-hmm. is this that would feel good to me emotionally, physically, in my body? And if the answer is no, it's not a big deal, because if you're hungry for cake later that night or the next day or a week from now, you can have it.
Yeah.
And I think you can also, you know, think about, like, you could even ask for a piece. Like, I'm not in the mood for now, but do you mind if I take a piece for later?
Mm.
You
know? Yeah.
Because it's not off limits, and you're not good because you didn't eat it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All of that. Yeah.
Yeah. That kind of feeling better than other people because you could say no to the cake, whereas they couldn't. Whereas actually you've then spent the next 24 hours thinking about how much you wanted that piece of cake because you deprived yourself.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, well, Judith, it's honestly been such a pleasure to speak to you. I feel like we could go on for so much longer. I just wanted to ask, whereabouts can people go to find out more about you, maybe to reach out or to read your book to find out more?
Yeah, well, the best way is to go to my website, www.judithmance.com.
Nice.
And there's a book page there, so you can find all the books listed there. And of course, they're on the usual websites, Amazon and all, and whatever other booksellers, you know, that you want to order from. I'm on Instagram at Jude Matz, JudMatz. And we have a Diet Survivors group Facebook. I assume you'll put the link.
Of course.
In the podcast. Yeah. Diet Survivors group was our first, the first book for the general public, Diet Survivors Handbook. And based on that, I also have a newsletter called the Diet Survivors Group Newsletter that comes out quarterly. From when this podcast will be broadcast, the next one will be in January, but you can sign up for that on my website. There's a place right at the top to just put in your name and email, and it'll come out 4 times a year. And there's always something around the season, like kind of a lesson kind of based on the Diet Survivors Handbook. And we always have something related to attuned eating, something related to weight and health matters, and any updates. And then I always give like a clinical example, like an example of somebody, like a vignette of somebody who's working their way through anything related to chronic dieting, binge eating, weight stigma, body image. And I don't give out those email addresses to anyone else. So 4 times a year only. So I'd love you to sign up for that as well.
Amazing. Well, I will be signing up as soon as we finish speaking, because it's been such a pleasure to speak to you. So I hope you have a lovely rest of your day and go and enjoy the weekend.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure to talk with you, Hannah.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode. So be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.